Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. Around the year 475, Sidonius Apollinaris, the Bishop of Clermont in what's today central France, wrote a letter to the famous Bishop of Reims, Saint Remigius. A clear attempt by Sidonius to network with a powerful figure, it was a flattering letter, complimenting the Bishop of Reims on the quality of his Latin prose in obsequious terms that would ring hollow and embarrassing to our ears. How well-educated, blue-blooded aristocrats in Roman Gaul talked to one another isn't what I want to focus on just now, though. I want to talk about the poor guy who had to carry that letter all the way from Clermont to Reims, a journey of some 380 miles. Put yourself in his shoes. You're probably a slave, though a trusted one, and you're about to leave your friends and family behind for an uncertain length of time on a dangerous journey. To get from Clermont to Reims, this courier had to tramp east along the well-worn Roman road, over gently sloping, wooded hills studded with vineyards that connected Clermont to Lyon, the major city of central Gaul. Your master has powerful friends in Lyon, which sits near the confluence of two major rivers, the Saône and the Rhône, and these great and good of the city are people with whom you can safely stay the night. From Lyon, though, you're out of the territory where your master has friends to look out for you. You turn north, winding through the lush fields that surround the Saône River as it leads to Châlons. From there, you turn east to the high walls of the city of Autun, then north through the lush, evergreen forests of Morvan to Troyes, and then you'd finally hit the last, utterly flat stretch of road that led to Reims itself. Even with a good horse at your disposal, that's a journey of at least 10 days in each direction. Leaving aside the misery of any long journey on horseback, you would have been in constant danger. In 475, Gaul was a fragmented patchwork of territories controlled by a vast array of competing powers and interests. In the course of your journey, you would have passed through land ruled by the Visigoths around Clermont, the Burgundians when you get to Lyon, and various ex-Roman generals turned warlords to the east of Paris before finally ending up in the territory of the Franks around Reims. In each of those places, there were outright bandits and war bands of soldiers, some of them more official than others. Many of them would have been happy to relieve you of any coin you carried, and maybe your life, if you got unlucky. While you would have had the benefit of well-paved Roman roads for the entirety of your journey, you would have noticed major differences in the course of your travels. Clermont was a stately, wealthy little city, though it was under constant threat from the Visigoths to the south. Lyon was a major hub with huge monumental buildings and palatial villas, along with warehouses stuffed full of goods that had come up the Rhône from the south or that were ready to head south to the ports on the Mediterranean. But when you turned east at Châlons and then north at Autun, things changed dramatically. You passed ruined villas that would have been luxurious homes for a wealthy aristocrat 50 years ago. Large stretches of countryside seemed outright empty, and you saw many buildings that had burned down in one of 100 barbarian incursions or petty wars. The cities you passed through were shrunken and partially deserted, their formerly grand buildings broken up for the stone they contained, their once imposing walls pulled down and breached in places by Attila the Hun 25 years before, or some other unmemorable barbarian incursion. As you reached the far north, near Reims, you noticed that more and more people weren't even speaking Latin. They were speaking Frankish, and it seemed like everyone was carrying weapons, especially axes. Villas that had been ruined a century or more ago competed for space in the landscape with freshly built, sunken-floored huts and timber longhouses. Gaul, more or less today's France and Belgium, along with part of the Netherlands and Germany, had been one of the heartlands of the Roman Empire. As you'd expect given that geographic range, it encompassed tremendous diversity within its borders. Over the course of the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries, Roman Gaul split along its fault lines into three distinct regions, each of which experienced the fall of the empire in drastically different ways. Dramatic transformations of the material landscape and demographic makeup took hold in some parts, while in others, you might barely notice any difference in life between 350 and 550. So what were these different regions? First, we have the north, broadly defined. Draw a line from Nantes, near the Atlantic coast about halfway up France, and connect it to Strasbourg in the east, near the border with modern-day Germany. That northern region includes Brittany, Paris, modern Belgium, about half of the Netherlands, and German cities in the Rhineland, like Cologne and Bonn. This region, especially its northernmost reaches, experienced the most drastic transformation with the end of the Roman world. In a lot of ways, the disruptions it experienced resembled those of Roman Britain, which we discussed in the last episode. Second, we have the southwest of Gaul, what we'll call Aquitaine. This includes cities like Toulouse and Bordeaux, and it extends from the Pyrenees in the south to Nantes and Tours in the north. The region around Clermont, the Auvergne, marks the eastern border. Now, this region went through some marked shifts during the period we're talking about, including the settlement of the Visigoths, but for a lot of people, things went right on like they had for the last couple of centuries. Finally, we have the southeast of the region, extending from Dijon and Lyon in the north down to Provence in the south. This was the wealthy, agricultural heartland of Roman Gaul, and it included the lush river valleys of the Loire and the Rhone. As Aquitaine had the Visigoths, this region had the Burgundians, but only a few things changed here for long periods. Unlike Aquitaine, however, this region's many outlets on the Mediterranean helped to tie it closely into smaller versions of the long-distance trade networks that had economically defined the Roman world. We'll focus on a few hypothetical individuals, like that poor slave who had to travel 800 miles to deliver Sidonius Apollinaris's letter to Remigius, to help us wrap our heads around the kinds of transformations and continuities that we see in the sources. We'll talk about a Roman aristocrat near Toulouse in Aquitaine, a member of a merchant family in the southeast in the city of Arles along the Mediterranean coast, and finally, the son of a Frankish warrior in the far north. So let's start with a basic narrative outline of Gaul's history and the later empire to get us going. We talked a few episodes ago about the crisis of the 3rd century, the series of serious issues that plagued the Roman Empire between 235 and 284. These problems, barbarian incursions, economic depression, loss of faith in governmental institutions, and local separatism, affected Gaul in major ways. The crisis of the 3rd century was when the major barbarian confederations that would have such a huge impact on the last couple of centuries of the Western Empire emerged. On the Danube, as we discussed at length, this meant the Goths. On the Rhine, this meant the Alemanni and the Franks. It took constant Roman attention to manage what was happening beyond the frontiers with a combination of money and military force. During the crisis, constant usurpations regularly stripped troops from the frontier and directed Roman interest toward internal rather than external issues. The money stopped, and so did the punitive and preemptive raids by Roman troops, which created a vacuum into which powerful, charismatic chieftains could step to forge new alliances like the Franks and the Alemanni from related but formerly unconnected barbarian groups. This led to a dramatic increase in the scope and intensity of barbarian raiding across the frontier, which sometimes culminated in full-scale invasions. Practically every Gallic town of any size built walls starting in the 3rd century. Now, you don't generally build walls unless you think that you'll need them, and the textual and archaeological evidence both suggest that they were necessary. In 260, right in the midst of the crisis, the governor of the province of Germania, Postumus, defeated a major Frankish incursion. In the aftermath of his victory, Postumus declared himself emperor and led what amounted to a breakaway Gallic empire. This separatist state lasted for nearly 15 years, until 274. But in the aftermath of the reunification of Gaul with the rest of the empire, the region took on a much more central importance than it had before. Diocletian, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, established an imperial capital at Trier, which sits along the Moselle River in what's now western Germany. Trier remained one of the most important administrative centers in the entire Western Empire until around 400, and it was full of blocky, imposing, late imperial buildings that are strong testimony to the city's importance. As home to one of the two Praetorian prefects, everything from Britain to Spain was administered from this city. The fact that the emperor and the praetorian prefect were so often resident in Gaul tied the region's aristocracy ever more closely to imperial politics, and it also drastically strengthened the region's economy. The Rhine frontier had always been a destination for staple goods like food and wine, since so much of the army was stationed there, but that process intensified when northern Gaul suddenly became an important political center as well. For the entirety of the 4th century, Gaul was increasingly central to high politics after several centuries of being a political backwater, if a prosperous one. Now, that imperial presence and the increasing weight of the administrative state didn't make itself felt equally across the province. There was a strong divide between north and south that predates the differences that we'll be discussing in today's episode. The aristocracy of the south was quite wealthy and was tied into the machinations of the imperial court, while the north was home to a less prosperous but militarized elite made up of army officers and administrators who depended on the state, much like they had in Britain. Now, the 4th century empire in the west was basically stable and functional, and the biggest reason for that stability and functionality was the fact that able, competent men held the imperial office for almost the entirety of the stretch between Diocletian and Theodosius. That most of these men made their residence at Trier, along the frontier in northern Gaul, was a big part of that competence. Here, they were well-placed to deal with raids and invasions from the other side of the border, and being so tied into the frontier armies meant that other generals were less able to win the loyalty of the troops necessary for a good, successful usurpation. This system started to break down at the end of the 4th century, with serious effects on especially northern Gaul. Gratian was the last emperor to rule the entire west who made his capital in Trier. The usurper Magnus Maximus, whom we talked about in the last episode in the context of usurpations in Britain, also ruled from that city, but he didn't control Italy or Spain. After Magnus Maximus was put down by Theodosius, that was the end of direct imperial rule from the Rhine frontier. Theodosius never traveled there, and his young son Honorius, who succeeded him, ruled from Italy. All the later emperors of the 5th century did as well. When the imperial court left northern Gaul for good, this had several effects. First, it meant an economic recession as government expenditures dropped. The administrators whose consumption of goods and services had driven the economy around Trier, for example, relocated and took their households with them. We're talking hundreds of incredibly wealthy people and thousands of their dependents who no longer needed food, staples, or luxury items, just suddenly gone from the economy. Second, it meant that imperial attention was basically elsewhere. A big part of the reason why emperors had moved to the Rhine frontier in the first place was to be able to deal with the increasingly serious barbarian incursions that had taken hold during the 3rd century. With the emperors gone, nobody was paying a whole lot of attention on the 31st of December, 405, when a huge body of Vandals, Sueves, and Alans crossed the Rhine. Franks working for the empire held off the invading barbarians as long as possible, even killing the Vandal king, but eventually they were overwhelmed. This incident is as close as this whole period of the later empire comes to the classic picture of a marauding horde of rampaging barbarians, and the Vandals, Sueves, and Alans earned that reputation. As far as we know, there was no real imperial response to this crisis, and it's in this context that the last great round of usurpations in the West took place. We talked in the episode about Britain about Constantine III, and how he stripped some of the last remaining troops from the island and took them to Gaul. This invasion of Vandals, Sueves, and Alans is why Constantine III did that, and it's why the inhabitants of the provinces of Gaul seem to have been happy to see him. The usurping Constantine pinned the invaders in the northern part of Gaul in short order, and it's only when his attention turned toward the Emperor Honorius and Roman imperial politics that the barbarians managed to slip past his troops and enter Spain. If you recall the last episode, this was the point when Britain was lost forever to the central authorities of the Roman Empire. The state had been losing its grasp for a while, but the end of Constantine's usurpation marked the final straw. The same holds true at this point for the northernmost parts of Gaul, and this is where the story of the province diverges into its three separate strands.
A If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
So now let's talk about our three hypothetical individuals and the regions they represent. We'll begin in the Southwest, in Aquitaine, with our blue-blooded aristocrat. Let's say he grew up in the rich agricultural lands around Bordeaux, to the northeast of Toulouse, the capital of the Visigothic kingdom, and that he came of age as a teenager around 450 or so. The aristocracy of this region had deep, deep roots, and they were some of the wealthiest and most powerful in the entire empire. They may not have had the massive, scattered landholdings of the Italian senatorial class, but they were still hyper-rich by any measure and lived lives of almost unimaginable luxury and comfort. By blood or by marriage, our friend, we'll call him Leontius, a name that makes him a member of one of the lesser-known but still widely dispersed and powerful families of southern Gaul, would have been related to all of the most important extended kin groups of the region. The Aviti were the most important, with branches in Clermont and Lyon, but there were also the Apollinares and many others whose names have been more or less lost to us. These extended kin networks were of the utmost importance for our friend Leontius, because they were the avenues of patronage and friendship that would have helped him secure an office in the imperial administration, wield influence at the imperial court in Italy, or strike up a conversation with the right Visigothic official. This was a personal world, and even more than their raw wealth or rank, it was easy access to these networks of power that set blue-blooded aristocrats apart from the rest of society. For our friend Leontius, much of his youth would have been focused on learning to tap into these kinds of networks. To do that, Leontius had to be properly educated. For an aristocrat of his station, that meant learning all the classics, Virgil, Cicero, Terence, Horace, Sallust, and many others, under the tutelage of a hired grammarian, probably a Greek slave. He'd then leave home for more advanced studies, probably in the city of Arles on the Mediterranean coast. Not only would he have learned rhetoric, oratory, and how to write in the hyper-literary style favored by men of his class, but he would have also made the kinds of connections with his fellow aristocrats at this school that would serve him well later in life. Letters were the glue that bound these aristocrats together, the tool that allowed someone like Leontius to tap into the power of his widely dispersed networks of fellow aristocrats. Let's say Leontius had a friend, a hard-working, educated young man born to a prosperous but not aristocratic family in Bordeaux. To advance himself, this young man would like to get a job in the imperial administration, but unless you know someone, that's never going to happen. Luckily, this young fellow knows Leontius, and Leontius's cousin, say, works directly for the Praetorian Prefect of Gaul. One letter to Leontius's cousin, a conversation with the Praetorian Prefect, and that's how Leontius's friend gets himself a job in the imperial administration. Here's an example of a recommendation that Sidonius Apollinaris, an aristocrat of this type, wrote around 465 to his friend Sagittarius. Quote, "The honorable Proiectus is ardently bent upon your friendship. I trust that you will not repel his advances. He is of noble lineage. The reputation of his father and uncle, and his grandfather's eminence in the church, unite to lend a luster to his name. He has indeed all that conduces to distinction, family, wealth, probity, energetic youth. But not till he is assured of your good graces will he consider himself to have attained the culminating point of his career. Now, this ability to tap into power and patronage was what distinguished aristocrats like Sidonius Apollinaris or our friend Leontius. Think of them like important nodes in networks, with tendrils extending downward to their own clients, men like Leontius's friend or the Proiectus whom Sidonius recommended, and then laterally, outwards, to other important people, who all had networks of their own that they could activate to find jobs or a good source of marble for your villa or what have you. So this was Leontius's world, a world of other hyper-educated and hyper-literate aristocrats who lived in luxurious, palatial country villas attended by dozens or even hundreds of slaves. Leontius had his own bathhouse, complete with both hot and cold pools, studded with marble from the Pyrenees. There were priceless mosaics decorating the floors and masterpiece paintings on the walls. There was even a bubbling fountain in the middle of the reception chamber where Leontius's father received his clients and underlings. This villa would have been surrounded by hundreds or thousands of acres of lush, productive farmland, olive groves, and vineyards, all worked by poor tenant farmers. If there were streams or rivers, some of Leontius's dependents would have operated fish traps to provide for themselves and Leontius's table. There also would have been industrial facilities at this villa, including weaving and possibly ceramics. In effect, the villa was both a palatial residence for aristocrats like Leontius and the center of a serious economic venture. Leontius and his peers might have owned several or even dozens of these estates. The countryside around Bordeaux and throughout Aquitaine as a whole was full of them. And yet, around 450, the world was changing for Leontius and other aristocrats of the region. Things had already changed dramatically in the last 30 years. The Visigoths had been settled by treaty around the city of Toulouse, and this changed the nature of the ruling elite in the region. Many of Leontius's relatives would have left the area of Visigothic control around the city, selling or even abandoning their estates and moving to the area around Arles or even on to Italy. In the years after 418, the Visigoths slowly but surely expanded their political dominance of Aquitaine and beyond. And not all of the Roman aristocracy of this region fled the Visigoths, nor was their takeover particularly violent. Many members of the elite simply ignored them, while others went to work in their administration, just as their fathers or grandfathers might have done for the imperial government before the Visigoths arrived. Still, things were changing. Leontius and his family paid taxes to the Visigoths, not the central Roman administration. And slowly but surely, Leontius was losing touch with family and acquaintances who lived outside the boundaries of Visigothic territory. The kinds of networks that made him an important person were getting harder and harder to maintain. In 455, a relative of Leontius's and every other blue blood in Gaul, named Avitus, declared himself emperor with the support of the Visigoths. Practically every major aristocrat in Gaul, both in Visigothic territory and outside it, supported Avitus's bid for the imperial throne. The Vandals had just sacked Rome, and the emperor, a ruthless incompetent named Petronius Maximus, was dead. The Visigoths had an army available. The time was right, and the means were there. So Avitus took Rome, and he brought many young Gallic aristocrats like Leontius with him. What happened after that shows just how divided the empire had become and what the future would look like. The Italian populace and senatorial elite rejected Avitus and both his Gothic and his Gallic followers as outsiders, and refused to support him. Avitus was defeated in battle and deposed, and probably murdered shortly thereafter. This was the end of the Gallic elite's attempts to involve themselves in the central politics of the empire. So Leontius would have returned home to Aquitaine, a man in his mid-20s with wealth and a great name. His father and his grandfather had served in the imperial administration, but after the Avitus affair, it was clear that the empire wasn't interested in the contributions of people like Leontius. In other words, the Gallic aristocracy grew increasingly restricted to Gaul itself and was essentially cut off from the central government of the empire. So what would Leontius do now? What career path might he follow? Well, he could simply while away his time engaged in the pursuit of otium, a Latin word that translates to something like cultured leisure. Aristocrats like Leontius elevated this practice to an art form, spending their time reading, engaging in philosophical debates with other educated people, practicing their public speaking, and writing. Men of Leontius's class wrote poetry and histories, and the more Christian among them wrote theological commentaries and reflections on the scriptures. Above all, they wrote letters constantly to maintain their social ties to the other great and good of the region, as we discussed before. But what if Leontius got tired of Otium, of his cultured leisure? What else could he do? Well, he might serve as a magistrate in Bordeaux or one of the small cities around it. That was a good, virtuous thing for an aristocrat to do, whether he also had a position in the imperial administration or not. But over the course of Leontius's lifetime, those city magistracies like the Curiales and the Decuriones were getting harder and harder to fill. Fewer and fewer aristocrats wanted to undertake the expense of providing services and games to the urban population, or to take the effort of going on an embassy. The cities were shrinking, anyway, and they were full of semi-derelict buildings and empty lots. Why commit to spending time in a rundown city when you have such a nice country villa? We even have a letter from Sidonius Apollinaris in which he upbraids a friend of his, a man named Pastor, for failing to appear at a city council meeting. Or perhaps, with Leontius and his Gallic aristocrat friends cut off from the imperial administration, he might consider taking a position with the Visigoths. After all, the Visigoths had a kingdom to run, even if that kingdom required less bureaucracy than the Roman state, and they needed experts in taxation and especially legal matters. An aristocrat named Leo of Narbonne, with whom Sidonius Apollinaris corresponded, was just such an administrator for the Visigothic king Euric in the 460s. But as a blue-blooded aristocrat, that may not have held much appeal. Archaeologically speaking, the Visigoths are invisible in Aquitaine in the near century that they held the region. There weren't that many of them relative to the population as a whole, and this means that they probably dressed much like the Roman elite, lived in Roman-style houses in the cities and villas in the countryside, and generally blended in. My hypothesis, as someone who's looked at this evidence in depth, is that very few of them even spoke Gothic at this point. Remember, by 450 there was nobody left who'd been born beyond the frontier, and the majority would have been born in Aquitaine. Most of them would have spoken a Latin generously spiced with Germanic words, a development of the standard army dialect. None of that would have mattered to Leontius or people of his social status, though. Even if they were hardly fresh arrivals to Aquitaine, the Visigoths were still barbarians, and thus, by nature, they were unworthy of mingling socially with the aristocratic elite. There was one other path open to people of Leontius' status. He could become a bishop. Note how little I've discussed Christianity with regard to our friend up to this point, largely because it wasn't a major part of his education. That was still firmly rooted in pagan classics, and in general, aristocrats were more concerned with the secular than the religious. A bishop, though, a bishop blended the kind of civic responsibilities that these aristocrats had been conditioned to pursue with spiritual leadership as well. Bishops weren't just supposed to tend the souls of their flocks in this period. The idea of pastoral care was still in development, and would be another century before the idea really took hold. Bishops were more like civic leaders, and it's not a coincidence that lists of bishops in Gaul in this period are studded with the names of the eminent families in the region. I mentioned the weakening roles of city officials in this period, the curials and the decurions, and into that gap stepped bishops. When the Visigoths were menacing the city of Clermont, for example, it was Sidonius Apollinaris, acting as the city's bishop, who organized the defense and tried to find aid. That was an increasingly common career path for men like our friend Leontius, and allowed them to maintain their lifestyles as aristocrats, dedicated to luxurious leisure, while still maintaining the kinds of important roles in their communities that they felt they should take up. You didn't even have to be celibate to be a bishop, and most of the ones we know intimately from 5th century Gaul had wives and children. As the 5th century wound into the 6th, life changed little for men like Leontius. Their horizons grew a little more restricted, and they gradually lost contact with their extended networks in southeastern France. The political instability caused by the end of the empire in the 470s and the constant conflicts between the realms of the Visigoths, Burgundians, and Franks created an environment where it just wasn't possible to keep up continuous correspondence outside the borders of the kingdom in which someone lived. Think about it like this. If I live in California and my friends and family live in, say, Texas, and California and Texas become separate countries, it might not feel like much of a difference at first. After all, you still speak the same language, the freeways still connect us, our form of government is still essentially the same. But if California and Texas fight a couple of wars, in 20 or 30 years, it's probably going to be difficult for us to regularly send messages to one another. The governments of California and Texas will question people who have a lot of friends in enemy territory. Here's how Sidonius Apollinaris, a contemporary of our friend Leontius, described that atmosphere of suspicion and danger. Quote, "A courier can by no means pass the guards of the public highroads without strict scrutiny. He may indeed incur no danger, being free from guilt, but he usually experiences a great deal of difficulty, as the watchful searcher pries into every last secret of the letter carriers, and if their answers to his questions should happen to show the least nervousness, they are believed to carry verbally in their heads the messages not committed to writing. Thus, the man sent often suffers ill treatment, and the sender acquires an ill name, more particularly in these days, when the established treaties of kingdoms long jealous of one another are made unstable by fresh conditions tending to produce discord." Still, there was nothing wrong with a more regionally restricted life, and men like Leontius, with the same kinds of literary tastes and massive landed estates, were still the wealthiest, most important people in their local communities. A few changes crept in over the course of the 6th century. Leontius' son, for example, might have been expected to take on a more military role, though he'd still have grown up in a villa and received the kind of education his father did while writing the same kinds of hyper-literate letters. Gradually, the military aspect became more important, and they blended into a combined aristocracy of rich landowners who continued to dominate the office of the bishop in their communities. Even after the Franks took Aquitaine from the Visigoths in 507, even after these men's villas fell into ruins by 600 or 650, the descendants of Leontius and his aristocratic peers would retain their local and regional dominance for centuries to come.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Let's move on from Aquitaine to southeast Gaul, to the region known as Provence. It had its aristocrats, men like Leontius, for whom little changed with the transition from imperial rule to that of the barbarian kingdoms. They too had their luxury villas, their hyper-literate networks of correspondence, their ability to tap into patronage networks, and their eventual transition into the role of bishop. But the cities of the Mediterranean seaboard, places like Arles, Narbonne, and increasingly Marseille, all continued operating as prosperous centers of trade. Even as the trade in bulk goods that had characterized the Roman economy, and even exchanges of small quantities of luxury items, disappeared from Britain and northern Gaul, the economy in southern Gaul kept right on chugging, almost as it had during the salad days of the 4th century economic recovery. To be clear, the scale was smaller, and the cities themselves shrank a bit, but this region remained urban, and it remained wealthy. Let's direct our attention to a person who embodies these trends. We'll call him Paulus, and say he was born around 440 or so in the city of Arles. Arles isn't particularly well known today. It's overshadowed by its bigger, richer neighbor Marseille. But in antiquity, Arles was by far the more important city of the two. After the imperial capital left Trier, for example, it briefly settled in Arles before moving on to Italy. So why was Arles important? Well, because it was the major port at the mouth of the Rhone River on the Mediterranean. While roads were important, rivers were the major commercial arteries of the pre-modern world. It was so much easier and more cost-effective to ship goods, especially bulk goods, by riverboat than it was to take them by ox-driven cart overland. the Rhone wasn't just any river, but the major route that linked the cities of Lyon and Vienne, and beyond them, all of the commercial networks of northern Gaul. If that weren't enough, Arles also sat at the points of intersection of the major roadways of Gaul, including the coastal route that connected Hispania to Italy and the north-south road that led into Provence and to Lyon. In network terms, Arles was a hub, an exchanger. It was the point where all of these different modes of transportation, riverboat traffic, ocean-going ships, overland hauling, all met, and where goods and people could transfer between each of these modes and move on to their next destinations. So let's come back to our friend Paulus. Paulus was a merchant, and for all of these reasons, there were few better places to be a merchant in the waning days of the Roman Empire than Arles. Now, Arles had shrunk a bit from its peak in the 1st and 2nd centuries, and not all of the area enclosed by its city walls was still occupied. The industrial mill complex just outside the city at Barbegal, one of the most impressive in the Roman world, was already in ruins by the time Paulus was born. Still, the city's amphitheater and its triumphal arch were exceptional ones, and benefactions by Constantine and Constantius II a century before had produced an enormous bath complex and a new forum. Unlike many other cities, that forum remained in use as a public space, and there was a brand new cathedral just near there from which the city's powerful bishops operated. Arles was a busy, wealthy city of between 20,000 and 40,000 inhabitants. Paulus could have looked at this urban landscape, the background to his daily life, with pride. But what about business? How did that work for our merchant friend? If Paulus were in the business of trade, it was almost certainly a family business, and Paulus would be following in his father's footsteps in that line of work. Paulus' father probably would have been a former slave, who got his start handling commercial activity for one of the rich aristocrats, a man like our friend Leontius, who invested some of his immense landed wealth in trade as well. Most freemen considered it beneath them to work for someone else, so it was usually slaves, though trusted, well-treated ones, who acted as commercial agents for aristocrats with capital to invest. If Paulus' father was good at this kind of work, he would have eventually accumulated enough money to purchase his freedom and to use the commercial contacts he'd made while working for his master to strike out on his own. His son Paulus could then follow him into that line of work without any hint of judgment or negativity associated with that background. The commercial classes were full of freedmen and the sons of freedmen. So what did that business actually look like? What did Paulus and his father, along with a bevy of slaves and hired day laborers, actually do? Well, they were in the shipping business. Remember, Arles wasn't so much a center of production, though it did have a rich agricultural hinterland and some pottery making, as it was a transshipment point for goods. But goods from where? Well, a major part of that shipping business would have been moving goods up and down the Rhone, from Arles to Lyon, and vice versa, or short-distance coastal traffic from Narbonne or Italy. The most important traffic, though, would have been long-distance ocean-going trade from Spain and especially North Africa. So what kind of goods are we talking about here? Primarily bulk foodstuffs, wine, oil, and grain, and pottery. The Western Mediterranean was an integrated system of exchange, moving those goods to feed the enormous cities of the Roman world whose agricultural hinterlands simply couldn't keep up with demand from their hundreds of thousands of residents. What the Romans discovered, though, was that even if the hinterland could produce a certain kind of good like oil or fish sauce, it was often easier or cheaper to produce it in scale elsewhere and then ship it. This sounds basic to us, since that's the defining characteristic of our globalized world, but for most of human history, it hasn't been a given. That system was breaking down a bit by the middle of the 5th century after the Vandals took North Africa and places like Britain and northern Gaul were cut off, but it was still basically in place in the Western Mediterranean. Arles was a hub in those networks of exchange, and Paulus and his family shipping business were cogs in that system. So picture Paulus standing on the docks in the year 476, meeting an enormous, round-bellied sailing ship just in from Carthage that had made its way through the Rhone Delta to the city by way of artificial channels called the Fossae Marinae. Now that ship carried a load of olive oil and amphorae and fine reddish pottery consisting of jugs, dishes, and bowls, all stamped with crosses and other decorative forms. Dozens of porters, some of them poor free laborers and others slaves owned by Paulus, would have rushed to unload the ship as quickly as possible, carrying the goods by hand and by cart to a nearby warehouse. Paulus might have handed over hard currency to the captain, either a hired man or more likely a slave of the business owner in Africa, in exchange for the goods. Maybe Paulus would have given him something like a letter of credit. It's hard to say, since our written sources are so incredibly uninterested in things like this, and nothing like that survives, but it's difficult to imagine goods moving in these kinds of quantities and values without some financial instruments to streamline the process. After moving the goods to his warehouse, Paulus arranged for the next phase of their journey. Some of the goods would be sold right there in Arles, but more of it was destined to be moved further along. Part of the cargo would travel via a coastal lugger, a small sailing ship, to Narbonne, where Paulus's agent would sell them to another merchant for overland transport to Toulouse, and from there on to Bordeaux, and eventually buyers like our friend Leontius and the people who lived and worked on his estates. More of that cargo, though, would be moved on a barge for transport upriver to Lyon, still a major city with a large population that demanded olive oil and fine tableware from Africa. The goods for which Paulus served as a middleman were distributed from Africa to Arles and from there to sites all over southern Gaul. They were the most common in big cities like Lyon and Narbonne, but they also went to palatial villas and even more modest rural sites. This was the case for the entirety of our friend Paulus's lifetime. Even though Arles passed from Roman rule to that of the Visigoths, then to the Burgundians, and then to the Ostrogoths, before falling to the Franks in the 530s, these networks of exchange remained in operation. The scale of that trade dropped, and Arles itself had shrunk substantially by the time Paulus's son was an elderly man, but it wouldn't disappear even in the days of his great-grandchildren. So this is the story of southern Gaul, a story of general continuity. It wasn't just the aristocracy that could go right on thinking that not all that much had changed with the end of direct Roman rule. As long as the taxes stayed about the same, there wasn't an army ripping apart his warehouses, the goods kept arriving from ports in Spain and North Africa, and he could find trading partners, did our friend Paulus really care whether he was ruled by a Roman emperor in Ravenna, a Visigoth in Toulouse, a Burgundian in Geneva, or a Frank somewhere north of the Seine? Nah, it probably didn't make that all that big a difference to him. Unlike Britain, which we discussed in last week's episode, the basic structures of society continued to function in Arles and the surrounding area. In northern Gaul, by contrast, things were much more like Britain than they were in Provence or Aquitaine. By the end of the 4th century, a dramatic transformation was already underway in the northernmost reaches of the province, in today's Belgium, Germany, and the Netherlands. That process was a little slower to reach cities further to the south like Paris, Metz, and Trier, which, if we recall, had been an imperial capital, but by the middle of the 5th century, that radical shift had hit them as well. So, when we talk about changes and transformations in northern Gaul, what exactly do we mean? Well, a few different things. First, the economy collapsed, much as it did in Britain, though not quite as dramatically as it had across the Channel. Second, settlement patterns in the region changed, with villas being destroyed or abandoned and replaced with materially simpler settlements of huts and wooden longhouses. Finally, society itself underwent massive transformations. People adopted different burial rites. Instead of Latin, more and more people started speaking Frankish. Weapons became more common, a reflection of the more fragmented and dangerous political landscape. So let's center our discussion on a hypothetical person in this landscape. We'll call him Clodio, and assume that he was born around 440, about the same time as our friend Paulus, maybe a little later than Leontius. Clodio's father is a Frank, a barbarian born beyond the Rhine in the vicinity of the city of Cologne. He joined the Roman army as a young man and spent most of his life living in what's now Belgium and northern France, fighting off Saxons, Alemanni, Franks, and even Romans. In that time, Clodio's father married a Roman woman and progressed through the military ranks, eventually coming to command a sizable unit under another Frank in Roman service. When Clodio was about 10, his father left home to fight against Attila's Huns when they invaded this part of Gaul, and like many other Franks in the Roman army, he didn't come back. I've made all of this sound a bit too clean, though, by talking about Clodio's father as a Frank in Roman service. By the time Clodio was born, the Roman state had effectively ceased to exist throughout northern Gaul, and that had been the case for decades by that point. Moving the capital from Trier was one factor, but what precipitated this catastrophe more than anything was the enormous invasion of Vandals, Suaves, and Alans in 405 and 406. It's what drew the usurper Constantine III from Britain into Gaul, and while he succeeded in restoring something like order to the region, northern Gaul was essentially forgotten when Constantine was caught and executed. Like Britain, northern Gaul had been a military province, one heavily dependent on direct state expenditures. As the home to a large number of troops, it required constant imports of supplies and manpower. The coinage paid to administrators and soldiers was spent on goods and services in local markets, providing a baseline level of economic activity on which everything else was built. Much of the agriculture in this region was organized around feeding those troops, though imports were also essential, and it was probably local merchants who served as middlemen for the business of keeping the soldiers in bread, oil, wine, and beer. This system was already under a tremendous amount of stress by the end of the 4th century. Barbarian incursions had increased in frequency, and the usurpation of Magnus Maximus in the 380s stripped the frontier of troops. The wars of the 4th century had already contributed to the abandonment of practically every villa in the far north and many further to the south, around places like Metz and Trier. By the middle of the 5th century, when Attila and his Huns launched their massive incursion into northern Gaul, there were very few Roman-style villas left even in these wealthier, more stable localities. This widespread instability hashed itself out in several ways. In the absence of the Roman state and the local hierarchies of power it created, with paid administrators and army officers, local landowners and former military commanders stepped into the gap. As we discussed with regard to Alaric and the Goths in previous episodes, the line between barbarian warband and Roman army was growing ever thinner in this period, and nowhere was this distinction less pronounced than in northern Gaul. In essence, the Romans handed over command of the border to warlords of Frankish, Alemanni, or other barbarian descent, or to militarized Roman aristocrats. A generation prior, men like this would have been formally integrated into the Roman military command structure and given proper titles and ranks. Now, however, there was little formal command structure to join. In this environment, we start to see lavish burials all over northern Gaul, from Paris and Reims to Brussels to the frontier itself, many of them including weapons. Historians and archaeologists used to interpret these as the burials of barbarian migrants, presumably Franks, into Roman territory, but recent opinion has swung towards seeing them as evidence of societal collapse. If you need to mark yourself out as an important person in an increasingly violent world, carrying weapons in life and being buried with them in death as a marker of your important warrior status makes sense. If you're asking me, I think it's a combination of these two. There were warrior migrants, Franks and Alemanni from around and beyond the Rhine into northern Gaul, but the society into which they moved also became increasingly militarized. This was the society into which our friend Clodio was born, one where a Roman army might be made up mostly of Franks or Alemanni and commanded by a Frankish, Alemanni, or Roman warlord. Clodio, unlike our friends Leontius and Paulus, was born a warrior into an increasingly militarized society. Even though his father had died, he was raised in a traveling military community of mixed Frankish and Latin speakers, the same kind of environment that made drawing a line between barbarian peoples like the Goths and a Roman army such a difficult task. In a society like that, it was understood that Clodio too would become a soldier. In the late Roman world, professions were generally hereditary, and soldiering was no exception. Where Leontius had Latin literature, oratory, and the operation of patronage networks drilled into him, and Paulus learned to negotiate with African merchants and to plan shipping routes, Clodio learned to fight. We talked earlier about identity, and that's no less the case for Clodio than it was for Goths like Vulfila. Being a barbarian, in this case a Frank, and being a soldier were inextricably linked. So when he was old enough, in the mid or late 450s, Clodio followed his father's example and joined an army himself, a band commanded by a talented young man, a little older than him, named Childeric. Childeric was a Frank, and like Clodio, so were most of the men under his command. Like Clodio, Childeric was following in his father's footsteps as a commander of one of these field armies. The area was full of these kinds of war bands. Some of them were commanded by Romans, men like the Magister Militum Aegidius, who operated out of the city of Soissons. Childeric and his band fought under Aegidius against the Burgundians and later to fight off a Visigothic invasion of northern Gaul, and with the Roman Count of Angers, first against the Visigoths and later against a band of marauding Saxons who had taken the city. It's a safe bet that they fought the expansionist Alemanni, who had pushed as far west as the city of Troyes, just southeast of Paris. By the time he was 30 or so, Clodio was a seasoned warrior in the service of Kilderic, with experience fighting a variety of enemies all across northern Gaul, from the Loire in the south to the Rhine frontier in the east. That's another important difference between Clodio and our other friends, Paulus and Leontius. Leontius took short trips to visit friends within the Visigothic kingdom, and Paulus likely traveled in the course of his shipping business, but both were essentially stable and rooted in either an estate or a city. Clodio, by contrast, was part of an itinerant world. He traveled and fought, fought and traveled, and if he had married by this point, his spouse and children traveled with him. I want to come back to this Roman Magister Militum Aegidius, whom I just mentioned fighting with Kilderic and our friend Clodio against the Visigoths. Aegidius had been a lieutenant of the last great Roman general, Aetius, from whom he received his title as Master of Soldiers and his army. And when Aetius was murdered, Aegidius took over in Gaul. What's noteworthy is that Aegidius relied almost entirely on Frankish troops. Our friend Clodio, through Kilderic, was one of them. Aegidius was a close ally of the Emperor Majorian, but when Majorian was murdered, 461, Aegidius struck out on his own. What was left of the Roman state in Italy didn't have any way of countering him. But here's where it gets even more interesting. Aegidius seems to have declared himself a king, and around this time, he forced Kilderic to flee to the north. Why? Well, because Kilderic was a rival, not just as a general, but as a king. Remember, most of Aegidius' troops were Franks, and Kilderic himself was a leader of Frankish troops. In that context, the line between being a king of the Franks and the Roman general in charge of the field army of northern Gaul, made up of Franks, was non-existent. It's telling that when Aegidius died, Kilderic immediately returned and became a king himself, a king not of a region, but of the Franks. This is also why Kilderic's son, Clovis, saw Aegidius' son, Syagrius, as his biggest rival, and went out of his way to capture and execute him. He was a rival, not just in a territorial sense, but as a potential leader of all the Franks in northern Gaul. Kilderic, and our friend Clodio along with him, emerged victorious from this series of power struggles between rival warlords contending for the leadership of armies and control of the region. The kingdom Kilderic founded was focused around Paris, where he spent a great deal of time, but his true power base was further to the north, in the former regions of Gallia Belgica. So let's take a step back and look at Clodio's world. For Leontius and Paulus, Christianity was the default state. Among the settled Romans of northern Gaul, Christianity was the default for them as well, but that wasn't necessarily the case for Clodio, some of his Frankish comrades-in-arms, or King Kilderic. They seem to have been pagans, who worshipped a pantheon of gods from beyond the Rhine, though there were surely some Christians among them as well. It was a more linguistically diverse world, too, with men like Clodio and his comrades speaking Frankish and perhaps some Latin, and the populace as a whole continuing to speak Latin, too. Warlords like Kilderic and Aegidius were more or less running larger-scale versions of the local protection rackets, complete with rapacious raiding, that we talked about in the episode on post-Roman Britain. Unlike in Britain, Kilderic and Aegidius partially maintained the mechanisms of taxation. This was a less economically prosperous world. In the far north, there was no more monetary economy, there were no more villas, and there were fewer people in general. Unlike Britain, there were still pottery production facilities that exported wares beyond the former boundaries of the empire, so there was some industrial activity. The money economy would return in a generation or two. Further to the south, between the Loire River and Paris, things were looking better. There were still some villas, and the monetary economy never stopped functioning, but there was still unavoidable economic decline. But for men like our friend Clodio, was this really a decline? By virtue of his association with a successful warlord like Kilderic, by making use of his skills and background, he had access to lands, wealth, and power in a way that his father or grandfather never would have. For Clodio and men like him, the Franks who slowly filtered into northern Gaul from across the Rhine, you could call this an aspirational story. Immigrants who filled a particular and necessary role in society and made good for themselves and their descendants. Kilderic, the warlord and then king to whom Clodio had pledged his loyalty, was the big bully in this world. It was a personal world, a face-to-face kind of world, rather than the more abstract administrative, institutional state of the Romans. When Kilderic died in 481, his son Clovis took over, and it's a safe bet that Clodio would have stuck with Clovis. Under Clovis's leadership, the Franks expanded out of northern Gaul, driving the Visigoths into Iberia and, under Clovis's sons, to take the entirety of the former Roman region and the lands beyond the Rhine as well. Clodio's sons and grandsons were with them, and that's how Gaul eventually became Francia, and then France. To give you a sense for what kind of personality Clovis was, and how his leadership differed from that of a Roman general 150 or 200 years before, and that of the Franks from a Roman army, I'm going to leave you with an anecdote from the later historian Gregory of Tours. So Clovis took the city of Soissons from the son of his father's enemy Aegidius, and he and his men collected the plunder. There was a particularly impressive ewer, a kind of jug, that Clovis coveted for himself, and all of his men were fine letting him have it. All, that is, except for one Frank. "You shall have none of this booty," the man said to Clovis, "except your fair share." And then the Frank took his axe and split the ewer into pieces. So here we can see that from a particular perspective, Clodio, Kilderic, and his ilk were nothing more than marauding bandits. Clovis didn't forget about this incident. When he inspected his Franks at the end of the year, he upbraided the man who had destroyed the ewer for having his weapons in poor condition. He threw the man's axe on the ground, and when the Frank bent over to retrieve it, Clovis used his axe to split the man's head open, shouting, quote, "That's what you did to my ewer at Soissons," wrote Gregory of Tours. Clovis ordered the others to dismiss. They were filled with mighty dread at what he had done. That world of Frankish armies and their looting, of warrior kings who weren't above doing their own dirty work, and a world that they molded in their image, is the story of Northern Gaul. So today we've seen the three paths the diverse provinces of Gaul took in the 5th century. There was mostly continuity for aristocrats like Leontius and Aquitaine, despite the fact that the Visigoths and not Roman officials controlled the region. Slowly but surely, though, the horizons of Leontius's world contracted. In the southeast, around Arles, very little at all changed for merchants like Paulus. They still imported their goods and sold them on to further markets, selling the same kinds of African pottery and agricultural produce in the same kinds of amphorae. In the north, though, a former Roman military province became a playground for warlords and their armies. The monetary economy collapsed like it did in Britain, and eventually Frankish laws displaced Roman ones. The Frankish language displaced Latin in many places. The frontier disappeared, and northern Gaul became ever more connected to the lands beyond the Rhine. Even within a single region, the end of the Roman world could play out in drastically different ways. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. I'll be posting bibliographies for this and future episodes for anyone who's interested in going deeper into the material, so keep an eye out for that. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.